Did Jesus get speared in the side? And if he did, wouldn't that be sufficient to kill him? Blood and water came out. And I understand from doing a little background on this, and my doctoral thesis happens to be in the field of patristics in the Church Fathers, it appears to me from the background material there that when a Roman soldier stuck a spear in a man's side when he was hanging on a cross, it was to make sure he was dead, and they did a fairly good job of it. And I'm sure that Jesus didn't scheme with some Roman soldier whom he just happened to pick out of about 50,000 around the neighborhood to be sure that he didn't stick it in too deep and twist it to kill him. That doesn't fit the Passover plot. It doesn't fit exegetically. It doesn't fit historically.
I didn't say so.
I know, but I'm just asking you to explain
how... Of course, it's very easy to explain.
I'm interested. I'm eagerly awaiting the explanations.
The explanation is absolutely simple. I haven't ignored the question of the spear thrust. I think it was an element in the story which Jesus had not anticipated. And there was no question of bribing any centurion or Roman soldier to do this. This took place unexpectedly. It was an unexpected thing, which actually led... No, not at the time. And several doctors, incidentally, have written to me to say that the emission of this blood and water was evidence that life was still in him. Now, this...
It's a fascinating diagnosis after 2,000 years.
No, not at all. It's not new. It's not a new thesis, and medical evidence has been given me in this connection, unsolicited. Now, I may say there that the conditions under which Jesus was taken down would have helped to enable him to recover. I agree with you. I'm not the first to suggest that he might have done, and that the fact that he was linen bandages, clean linen bandages and spices were applied to his body would have greatly assisted this. Now, you are choosing rather in the same way as Mr. Ousler, to pick and choose what you want to do from my writing.
No, sir. We're talking about the new book titled The Passover Plot. It's a new interpretation of the life and death of Jesus by Dr. Sconville. And as of November 13th, 1966, this book was considered to be America's most controversial bestseller. And up to that time, 140,000 copies were in print. That's only 10 weeks after publication. It is a book that I'd like to have you read. Whether you agree or disagree with Dr. Sconville, you must read it, because otherwise you cannot intelligently discuss it. And I don't think that Will read it, because... He isn't intelligent. No, I'm sorry. That's something I don't know who wrote that, but we'll have to bring that
right out. And don't have that writer in anymore.
Will Ousler is with us tonight, and we have Professor Walter Martin, director of the Christian Research Institute of Wayne, New Jersey. My name, Long John Neville, and I preempted you, so pick it up again, Walter, please.
Now, Dr. Sconfield said that I was doing the same thing Will was doing, picking and choosing sources to criticize his book. This is not true simply because Dr. Sconfield, having written the book, has introduced a vast number of theories in this book, which he himself admits on page 15. Therefore, if a scholar comes along and takes some of his pet theories and demolishes them, he can hardly be accused of being unfair simply because he takes the theories you have advanced and takes them apart. Now, you are perfectly at liberty to advance theories, and I'm sure as a student of the Scriptures, nobody is going to argue with you about setting forth a hypothesis. But you really can't accuse somebody of being unscholarly, or for that matter, of not playing cricket with you, because they select the theories you advance, which you print in your book, and demolish them one by one. With the taking them one by one, that's hardly being unfair. I mean, we could hardly take in the time we've got all the pages. Now, the thing that disturbs me most, as I pointed out, is the method that you use for interpretation. You said to Will a few minutes ago, which shocked me, you said, Lazarus's account of the resurrection appears in one gospel, as if the fact that it appears in only one gospel means we reject it. If you know, and I'm sure you do, that there are events in Luke that are not chronicled in Matthew, and events in Matthew not chronicled in Mark, and events in Mark not chronicled in John, and if we adapt your methodology, which you tried to use to refute Will, we will annihilate the New Testament in very short order. So your argument that you can dismiss Lazarus because he's only in John doesn't hold any water scholastically. That's the first thing.
I think, may I just say one word there? And that is this. We can't go on discussing on the kind of basis we're following at the moment.
which is, on Mr. Ousler's side, one of largely of invective. On your side, on your
as a piece of invective.
On your side, Dr. Martin, one of assuming something and then demolishing a red herring.
Well, I've only quoted you.
No, on the contrary, you have chosen to quote me and then put your interpretation on the quotation. You haven't talked at all, either of you. Of the question of on what basis does one evaluate the gospel records, how they came into being, what is the measure of their reliability before one starts to use them as in any kind of evidential way in any case. In my book, The Passover Plot, I have taken the trouble on the basis not just of my own investigations but of the work of many great Christian scholars to go into these very vital questions of the conditions and circumstances in which these books were written, which give a very different kind of order of merit, shall I say, to the different writers writing in different circumstances. And all this is a matter which you have to deal with if you are going to take the line you are following now.
Dr. Schonfield, might I point out, sir, that in a number of places in the book, you state your criterion for evaluating the texts of the New Testament. And it appears to me that the criterion which you use for evaluating the texts of the New Testament is that whatever is supernatural is rejected a priori. I quote you on page 49 in one of your
dodging the issue.
Opening. No, I'm quoting you. I mean, I don't want to be accused of hearsay. This is your approach to the New Testament when you get to the birth of Jesus. Quote, with the birth stories of Jesus and of John the Baptist also, we pass directly from the world of sober reality into the world of fairy tale. Now, of course, you're certainly entitled to believe that's true. But it's a fascinating thing that you can set aside the gospel of Matthew's account, the Gospel of Luke's account, and describe it as a fairy tale with no historical critique.
I beg your pardon. There is a critique. And it's there. And you choose to ignore it. This is what I'm saying.
Can I finish, sir? No historical critique of the material apart from the fact of saying that it's supernatural and should be rejected.
Then obviously you've not read the book.
Well, very carefully.
This is just a typical illustration of the kind of the way that you two gentlemen are approaching this question. I have clearly laid down and stated there that at that very time the Jewish people themselves had fairy tales relating to their ancient heroes for the birth of Abraham and the birth of Moses and the birth of Noah, of which we have concrete evidence in actual documents in our possession and which are parallel with the stories of the birth of Jesus as reproduced in several of these features. Now
who says they're parallel, Doctor?
Because when you find exactly the same ingredients, exactly the same kind of thing, for instance, if I refer to the birth of Abraham, I learn from these Jewish legends of the time of Christ that a star arose in the heavens and that wise men said that a king as a consequence was being born, that these wise men went to the king in Mesopotamia and that the king therefore decreed that the child that should be born was to be killed, but in a miraculous fashion that child was saved. Now, there is one element in the story in the Gospel of Matthew which is absolutely identical with the contemporary birth stories in Jewish legend of the birth of Abraham.
So you assume from this that because there is an apparent parallelism between a story, that one is the source of the other. Is that correct?
No, I did not. And that shows again that you've not read my book. What I said is that these stories regarding Israel's ancient heroes, like Abraham and Moses and so on, were invented as folklore stories to pay tribute to these great men in this kind of way. And that in implying similar stories to the birth of Jesus, this was equally a way of paying tribute to the birth of a great man, no less than the Messiah who was coming and who was the last of the great men in the whole of the Hebrew succession.
But the thing is so disturbing, Dr. Schoenfield, is the fact that you consider that unless somebody agrees with your evaluation of the New Testament documents and comes to your conclusions that they're not impartial.
Again, you haven't read my book, because in my book I have very clearly stated, in plain black and white, that I am presenting here the evidence as I see it and judge it, and what I am supplying is the sources which have been available to me, and I am making equally those sources available to others, and I have said categorically that I am not asking you to come to the same conclusions on this evidence that I do.
But you say...
I am asking, and I say this in the book, that you do not come to any conclusions without considering these sources and this evidence, which most people are not even aware of in any detail. Therefore, I am not pressing my conclusions upon anybody. Categorically, in my book, I've said, form your own. But don't ignore, if you're going to form conclusions, the evidence and the kind of evidence which I have presented here and this source material on which all judgment must be formed, unless you're prepared to take account of such evidence and such material, you are not entitled to form a judgment at all, or if it is one, it is a purely arbitrary one.
May I quote you to you?
Or do?
Quote. If you can approach that evidence impartially, that's the New Testament, I would suggest you would reach much the same conclusions I reached. If you are not approaching it impartially, you would probably have a different view. Close quote.
Which page, please? I'm sure you're not quoting me at all. I never said that.
You're positive?
I'm positive. I didn't use those words.
Well, that says what page?
Just a minute, John. I want to get this straight before we go any further. Another thing that disturbs me...
No, wait a minute. No, but let's take it step
by step. Well, I want to take the two quotes.
Oh, all right. Go ahead.
May I?
Double up.
Okay.
Go ahead. Double up if you want.
Another thing that disturbs me is the breathtaking dogmatism, so unlike the English, generally, that...
Is this a quote or is this your opinion?
It's a quote
now?
Coming.
Oh, quote is coming.
Yeah, quote coming.
Please tell us
to the effect. To the effect that nobody can contradict the evidence of the Passover plot successfully. I quote you again to you. Quote. There is... And I can assure you of this, not one single scrap of evidence to contradict anything that I have said in the Passover plot. Not one scrap. I know every fragment of material that exists. This is the result of my 40 years of research. No single person, whether in the church or in the temple, wherever it may be, or in any theological college, is in a position to put forward one tiny shred of evidence in contradiction. Close quote. That's you.
Now, may I just say this?
That is the most breathtaking statement I have ever heard.
May I say this? That I think that you will agree with me and the listeners will agree. If there is any accuracy in that quote, certainly this is not the way the man speaks. We're not talking about the timbre of his voice.
Well, I can't imitate his English accent.
No, I didn't ask you to imitate his English accent.
Yeah.
But you put an entirely different tone to a very simple statement. Is that your quote, sir?
This quotation that has been made is not from my book and isn't in my book.
I'd say it was.
You said you're quoting me.
I am.
And this is part of an exaggerated quotation of something I said on some radio program.
It's an exaggerated quotation?
Yes. What is true in that I did say that is in that... is that no one is in a position to produce
this is
a
the
piece
tape,
of contrary evidence.
Word for word, no exaggeration, of every single thing you said on that program.
On what program?
A program broadcast on television in New York City over station to Channel 31, in which you made the following statement. I had verified, got the tape to be sure, in which you made this statement, that you and you alone have ever made that I know of any person purporting to be a scholar of the Bible, that nobody could contradict anything that you said in the Passover plot. Not one scrap. I'll read it as quietly as I can. I know every fragment of material that exists. This is the result of my 40 years of research, and no single person, whether in the church or in the temple, wherever it may be or in any theological college, is in a position to put forward one tiny shred of evidence in contradiction. Close quote. I submit, Dr. Schoenfield, that your position on the Passover plot supersedes the canonicity of the Old Testament.
I beg your pardon. Now, let's take two things. One, I dispute that all the words that you have used are on that tape.
John, put the tape on. I marked the places.
The second thing is that what I was talking about there is documentary evidence.
You
miss. No, I beg your pardon.
That's in
this,
context. And in I've the got context, it on that tape.
In the context of this, what I said was that there was no shred of evidence of which I was not aware. Documentary evidence.
You
every single piece I've employed.
You said this.
There is no piece of evidence known to any scholar that is not known to me. Every fragment I'm aware of.
You went further than that.
I didn't.
There is, quote, and I can assure you of this, you were quite emphatic.
Yes.
Not one single scrap of evidence to contradict anything that I have said.
And this is what I'm talking about.
In
evidence,
the Passover
documentary
plot.
Evidence.
You sure there's none?
No, absolutely.
You have thoroughly researched all the fragments of the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Absolutely.
You have had access to the Dead Sea Scrolls.
You possibly don't know it, but I was one of the first scholars working on the scrolls.
You worked on them?
Yes.
Yes. And you've been through all of them?
Of course, I've been through all of them that have been published.
In other words, you haven't worked on the scrolls actually themselves with the individuals who were working on them and deciphering
them. No, I beg your pardon. You're interpreting again. There is
I don't know. I'm just asking.
I'm answering your question by saying there's a large part of the material of the scrolls which has not yet been published. I have not been able to utilize.
I mean, as a translator, did you have access to the scrolls themselves personally?
I had access. I have seen the scrolls personally, but I wasn't working any more than a large number of the scholars who have worked on the scrolls were on the actual documents themselves. What we worked on was infrared photographs, which fully brought out the writing very much more clearly than the actual manuscripts themselves.
Well, the point that I'm trying to bring out is, I think, quite a strong point. And that is that your approach to the Passover plot is that nobody who disagrees with you is impartial. You alone are impartial. If we don't come to your conclusions, we're biased. Yet, your conclusions, as an unbeliever, and one who denies our Lord and has accused him of every conceivable type of thing, you're unbiased. We're supposed to take you at face value. I don't buy this.
I don't either. I don't buy what you say, because I think you're deliberately misinterpreting.
May I ask you a question?
That of all of the people that I've talked to, Reverend Martin, people who are students of the Bible, and I'm not referring to the many rabbis that I have on the show, but people of the Christian faith. Now, the various priests, members of the Catholic faith that I have on, have certainly not concurred with what Dr. Schoenfield has said in the book. But they certainly do not feel, and I feel that there's an implication in your presentation of your opinion that you feel that he has done something to harm the name of Jesus Christ.
Yes,
Well,
of course.
And I must say that other people do not think so either. This is an opinion on the part of a man. First of all, what do you know about Jesus Christ from the age of 12 to about 30, Reverend Martin?
Very little.
Very little.
Anything.
That's quite a long time, isn't it?
Pardon?
That's a long time.
Oh, yes, that's quite a while.
12 to, in other words, it's a little less than, let's even say, let's cut it down to 15 years.
What has this to do with the question?
Well, what happened during those 15 years? Could you help me with that?
I don't know.
Well, why is it you don't?
Because we have no data.
I see. Why is that? Why is that missing from the records?
I haven't any idea.
Well, then why do you insist that Dr. Schoenfield is wrong, and why do you feel that
he hasn't anything either.
I didn't say he had.
Nor does he claim to, but I know.
Would you want to use the microphone, or are you going to do this telepathically tonight?
No, I'm working on it hard.
Thank you very much. Then let me ask you this. Why is it that a man, let's forget about it, the age of 12 for a moment, let's jump to 30, why is it that you feel that a 30-year-old man could not have come up with this idea with good intentions in mind to help the people?
Because the only primary source material, I say primary now in a scholastic sense, on the person of Jesus of Nazareth is the New Testament records, granted by Dr. Schoenfield.
Mm-hmm.
The material which he uses, which he lists in his bibliography here, etc., is material of apocryphal nature? Material written that has no direct bearing upon our Lord himself. He attaches Essene connections to Jesus, a sect that lived at that time, but he says that Christ repudiated portions of it. How he knows this, nobody knows, because there isn't any evidence of it in the Dead Sea Scrolls. In addition to this, he makes breathtaking statements about James the Just being an Essene. There's no evidence that James is an Essene at all, the brother of our Lord. He makes statements in the book repeatedly. Let me finish this point now.
All right, finish this point. I have a question I want you to help me with.
He makes statements repeatedly in the book, which are theoretical. I've cataloged 18 statements. Let me finish now. I've got to finish. You're going to question me, but let me finish now. He makes statements, at least 18 that I've cataloged to date, and I've been through the book three times, 18 that I've cataloged so far, totally unsupported by any scholastic authorities. They're just opinions.
Now, let me ask you this as an authority.
I'm finished.
Well, I'm not going to let you do 18 bits on me.
I'm not going to.
Believe me,
you're
not.
I'm trying to finish the sentence.
Sir, the fact is that you don't happen to have any periods around during your time of making these statements doesn't mean that the sentence isn't completed.
In other
words,
you
keep throwing commas in.
Are you going to question me?
I sure am.
Go ahead.
I would like to ask you this as an authority.
I'm not an authority. I'm just a student.
Oh, then you're like Neville, right?
Well, I wouldn't say that.
No?
No.
I see. You know more than I do.
I'm like Socrates.
Do you know
I don't know as much as Dr. Schoenfield maintains he does.
Do you know more than I do?
Of the Bible?
About the Bible.
Absolutely.
Fine. Then I can ask you a question, and I know that you'll have the answer.
I hope I do.
Why do you, as a student of the Bible, first of all, you believe that Jesus Christ was born of Mary?
Right.
All right.
So is Dr. Schoenfield.
I can't debate that with you. We come to the age of 12 and we miss this man, right?
According to the record.
But do you have something else that you were going to surprise us with tonight? I know you have a tape from Channel 31. You don't have a tape recording from back at the time of Jesus Christ, do you?
John, you seem nettled by that tape.
No.
You sore because I did some research?
No. I'm happy that you've done some research, but I hope that you have some answers for this question.
I got some. If you got questions.
Why is it that everybody automatically accepts the fact that the 30-year-old man is the same man that was born of Mary?
Why do they accept it?
Mm-hmm.
Because of the prima facie testimony of the New Testament and the record of the...
What record?
The record.
What record is there if we miss from 12 to 30? The ages,
the
from
gospel,
12 to 30.
The gospel accounts of the life and ministry of our Lord from 30 on...
I know, but what about from 12 to 30? I'm aware of the 30
this.
On.
They don't discuss this.
Well, then why do you automatically accept that this is the same man? I'm not saying it isn't, but why are you so sure it is?
Well, this is very silly, John, because...
It may be silly to you, but I'd like to have you answer my silly question.
It's very silly because the same record that tells us that Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king also tells us that when Jesus began to be about 30 years of age, he began his public ministry. So if we accept the record of his birth, which you just started out with as a basic premise...
Yes.
...by what reason would I reject the discussion of his ministry, which is in the same record?
What do you mean it's in the same record?
Now, come, John. You just quoted to me that he was born of Mary. That's in...
No, I asked you the question, and you told me, so I'm going to accept that.
It's quoted in Matthew.
You're the expert.
It's quoted in Matthew and Luke.
But why is it that you assume that a boy who is last known at the age of 12 and all of a sudden that he is 30, that he is the Messiah?
Because the record... Oh, wait a minute. You asked me a different question.
Well, I have a lot of questions.
You asked me first if it was the same person.
That's right.
I proved that.
You haven't proved it to me.
Well, I could never prove anything to you because you're an atheist. You begin with believing that it isn't true anyhow, so you won't accept any evidence.
I see. All right, continue.
So we just dismissed that a priori. Mm-hmm. As far as the evidence of the text itself, why do I believe he's the Messiah? I believe it because of the New Testament record. I believe it because of the testimony of the church and the early church and the church fathers. And I believe it because I have a personal relationship with him by faith. He's my Lord and my Savior. And when I read a book like The Passover Plot that says nice things about Jesus while it portrays him as nothing more than a glorified con man, that disturbs me.
I would say that I think that your terms are inappropriate, the adjectives that you use. I don't think that that anybody is suggesting the man is a con man.
Would have been nicer.
No.
No,
oh,
I think the Passover plot makes him a confidence
man.
Yeah, a
sidewalk magician, I think. Yes.
Now, let's take one point that I can answer your question.
Yes, please.
Professor Martin cannot. And that is that Jesus, after he started his public ministry, after his baptism, went and preached in the synagogue of his hometown in Nazareth. And we're told in the record that the people were extremely surprised at what he was saying and said, where did he get this wisdom and where did he get this information and this knowledge? In other words, they were looking at him with new eyes. They saw a man there who had grown up among them and who appeared to be speaking in quite a different way from the man with whom they had been familiar. Now, this is definitely stated in the Gospel of Mark and does give us one inkling of the fact that Jesus had undergone, in fact, a maturing and a change, and that he was not exactly the same person as he had been previously, a person who did not register anything very important about himself to his fellow townsmen in all those years that he had lived among them. Now, this is very interesting because, according to the view that Martin would hold as a believer, he must think that Jesus was God incarnate throughout all those years, that he was born such, that he grew up such, and yet until after his baptism, he performed no miracle of which there is any record. He didn't heal the sick. The townsmen knew nothing about him of having any particular powers at all. Now why, if this man was the man of love and compassion who insisted on healing all and sundry, why did he ignore the population in all those years previously and only start to do the things that he did when he was past 30 years of age? Now this is very important. If it was the same man and who was a divine being, why was this?
Could you hold it a moment, Reverend Martin?
Thank you, John.
Thank you. We have a couple of telegrams here. One, your show with Father DePauw was superb. You and Miss Copper are to be congratulated. God bless you both, and best wishes, signed Joe Teresa Smith of Cliffside Park, New Jersey. I think that's the young lady that Roberta Copper, who produces the show, was in touch with to arrange for the appearance of Father DePauw. Father DePauw is the Catholic priest who has had some difficulties with Bishop Sheehan in Baltimore. In fact, I think we are going to have him on the all-night show in another week or so. Here's another telegram. Your guests seem to be ignoring God and God's will in the entire program. Why? Signed, interested listener, Celia Harrison. Our guest tonight, the Reverend Walter R. Martin, director of the Christian Research Institute in Wayne, New Jersey, and associate minister of Van Riper Ellis Memorial Church, which is located in Fairlawn, New Jersey. Will Osler, author, Will's most recent book, is titled The Atheist. It is not autobiographical. Our guest tonight is the author of the new book that is one of the best-selling books today, a very controversial book written by Dr. Hugh J. Schonfield. And Dr. Schonfield is our guest. The title of the book is The Passover Plot. It's a new interpretation of the life and death of Jesus. My name, Long John Neville. Will, you look like you're anxious to
say
something.
I just realized one thing that I'd like to bring out, if I might. You have been talking so much about interpretations, Dr. Schonfield, that I seem to remember something. I'm sorry, Schonfield.
Because he was calling you Oozler before the show.
We were doing
corrected.
We were all in the same bag. I would like to take up the question of Joseph of Arimathea. Now, what's interesting about that is that you spoke of him earlier, if I don't mistake, as having been the man who was a secret disciple of Jesus, and you speak of him also as having probably supplied a drug to the crucifixion. Although I don't know where you get the evidence for the drug, but as a writer of detective stories, I know that you can invent a weapon and bring it in, and possibly it's so. I don't know what biblical support there is for a drug. I'm not a real scholar of the Bible, but let's assume, for the sake of argument, that this is correct, You also say that, and it plays here in the book, it has been noted by scholars that Joseph asked for the body, soma, of Jesus, which would indicate that he did not think of him as dead. Indicate, I guess, doesn't prove it. Then you said Joseph hurried to Golgotha with clean linen and spices. You also say somewhere that John refers to him as a secret disciple.
Excuse me, Will, what was the reference to that
soma?
Soma, yeah.
It doesn't give a reference except, let's see, Mark. Is that Mark? Is that Mark, Dr. Schultz?
I'm not sure offhand.
Well, the point that bothers me is that gives me a chance to show you what I object to in your book specifically is this particular thing. We go on here for pages. You say, for example, and these are stated as facts. These are not stated as. These are stated as a thing that you have, or we are dealing with as a fact. You don't say, in my theory, it could have been. You say, directly it was seen that the drug had worked. Now, this is the drug that you surmise. The man hastened to Joseph, who was anxiously waiting for the news. Now, this was 2,000 years ago, and there was Joseph waiting for the news, and you state this as a fact. You don't say that this could have happened or that this is a conjecture and that you're picturing it and dramatizing it. At once he sought an audience with Pilate, to whom he would have already had access as a member of the Sanhedrin and so forth. Now, you say all of these things as though Joseph actually did all of these things. Yet, on the previous page of your very book, although you state all of these things as facts, and a reader who isn't careful would undoubtedly be carried along by the very flow of your narrative, you state, and you have told us tonight with no hesitancy, you said to the listening audience here, you said that Joseph of Arimathea was a chief mover in this conspiracy of Jesus. So as a detective story writer of old, at least, I could assume that we could call him an accessory both before and after the fact of the crime that Jesus was being accused of committing in a book that I would call The Second Crucifixion. Now, after having depicted this man as being very much real, in your own sentences, and I can read them to more of them, but here are the things that you say about him, which I find very interesting. The very name Joseph of Arimathea, you say, is questionable. Josephus, according to his autobiography, telling of his own eminent ancestry, states that his grandfather, Joseph, begot Matthias in the 10th year of the reign of, how do you say that, Archelaus?
Archelaus.
That's in AD 6. The Greek text of the word Joseph, begot Matthias, is simply Josephou Matthias. My language in this, I'm not a student of it, as you can see. The name of Joseph of Arimathea is given in the Greek of Mark as Joseph Apo Arimathias. The similarity is striking. Now, I don't know whether you're saying there that possibly this was just a made-up story. It certainly is curious, you say, that we have Josephus himself, a Josephou Matthias, begging the Roman commander for the bodies of three crucified friends, one of whom is brought back to life. Now, what you're doing there is throwing doubt upon the whole story, which in the rest of this and here tonight over the air to our thousands of listeners, you said was an absolute proven fact. And you yourself here have a whole paragraph in which you don't even, you say the very name of the man that you say did all these things is questionable.
Yes, so what in fact you are doing is admitting my impartiality in
no,
the matter.
No, I am not, sir. I am admitting your very, very silliness in not catching that little mistake that you made yourself.
No, no, no.
And now I'm speaking
a
as a detective and not as anything else.
You may be a detective, but this wasn't
I'm
a mistake
as
at
one
all.
Here.
In
you
my
just made a slip, you know.
No, I didn't make it. I assure you
slip.
It was no slip. And I have worked so conscientiously in my work for such a great many years that I don't think anyone who knows my work would accuse me in the way that you have done. I felt obliged to bring in certain considerations which we have in records which affected the matter, and after that I have gone on. It may be that There was no Joseph Arimathea of that name. This name may have come from this other source in Josephus. We just can't know these things. But we have a right to present every scrap of information having a bearing on the subject. I have said, and you haven't read this part of my book.
I can't remember every book that was written. I beg your pardon, but you had just been quoting from particular pages of my book. I've been reading it.
Precisely, but the bit where I mentioned certain things, you choose to leave out.
No, I don't.
This is what
to
you've been
out.
Doing well, been in fact, all the way along, which is the arbitrary kind of fashion in which this discussion has been proceeding. And I must
and
say,
I find
it very distasteful.
I find it very uncomfortable. So there we are.
That people who are claiming to be such great champions of Christ in such a form can evince so very little of the spirit which you attribute to him. You are behaving, both of you, if I may say so, without any feeling of hostility, that you are criticizing me in very much the same way as the Pharisees in the Gospels criticized Jesus. That immediately the conclusion is that the person concerned, because they are dealing with evidential material and because they are trying to be honest with that material, are therefore animated by an evil and wrongful purpose.
No, sir,
and
I am not saying anything of the kind, and I beg your pardon, but both of you in one word or another
have said just that.
No, all we are doing is criticizing your book for the errors that we have found in it.
You're criticizing me.
Well, you wrote it, but that's all I'm criticizing.
Dr. Schoenfield,
you wrote it, sir.
I intended in my discourses nothing personal as far as an attack upon yourself is concerned. I question very seriously your conclusions. I question very seriously your methodology.
You may have fully entitled to it.
I think that some of the things that you say in here, that you are taking offense unduly. I think you have to realize that when you write a book about the person of our Lord, the way this book reads, to you it may not read this way. To a Christian, to someone who is committed, not a liberal Christian,
but someone who... I'm a liberal Christian.
No, but I mean somebody who believes the record itself, in many instances, and you do. It becomes very grating to have somebody come along and just pick and choose out of the New Testament what seems to please them, and I maintain vigorously that this is precisely what the Passover plot does. You take portions out of the gospel records, and you base your suppositions for the theory of the Passover plot upon this evidence. You equally dismiss evidence to the contrary without even so much as even a discussion of it. It's just
hasn't been produced tonight, sir.
Well, I believe we can produce a great deal of it.
Would you just let me finish the point that I was making about Joseph?
Reams of it, if you want.
If I may say so, sir, Joseph does it very well, because, you see, you at one point say that this man... His very name is not known. Yet you base the whole heart of the plot of Jesus, the fact that he was drugged, and that this is the man who did it, is built around this man. If the person who is the main accessory, both before and after the act of administering a drug to Jesus on the cross, an act which would have been a part of the conspiracy that you allege Jesus entered into with this man, if that man's whole existence, in your own words and in your own book, is highly dubious and questionable to the point that we don't even know that his name is correct, and that his name might have come from somebody who wrote about him sometime later, then I would say that the whole core of what you call the Passover plot falls apart in your own admitted ignorance of the man whom you say was the chief accessory. Now, if you consider that to be personal, you can, but I'm telling you, all I'm saying is, as a writer, you have to deal with what you have written. You wrote it. I didn't.
Yeah, but you left out purposely the part that I wrote in connection with this very story that didn't please you. And this
I did
is what
not
you
read out anything
that
just
is what you have been doing all along. And I can quote to you, and I have turned up the page, just because I don't like this kind of thing being done, and I don't think it is either honest or sincere. That is merely making fun of something because one has no case. This is what I actually said here, and I think that you're entitled, if you choose to quote such passages as you've done, to quote this too.
I've said one of the possibilities we have to face.
What page is this?
This is page 163 foot.
Well, I didn't see this.
Well, no, you
this
didn't.
This is on the other page, and I did not leave it out deliberately.
I don't even know this is indirectly in connection with this question of Joseph of Arimathea, which you have been proceeding to quote
I'm
to
I'm only
me.
Quoting what you
Will
wrote.
Will you please a moment, Will, let him finish the statement?
Certainly.
You see, I have there said that about Joseph of Arimathea, he's represented to us. This person is identified to us in the Gospels as Joseph of Arimathea. He is one of the great mysteries of the Gospels. He is represented as a wealthy man and a member of the Sanhedrin, and since he is said to have been waiting for the kingdom of God, he would have been a messianically minded Pharisee. He enters the story unheralded, and after his task is fulfilled, he disappears completely from the New Testament records. There is no indication whatever of his association with the apostles or that he openly joined the Nazarene movement. And then I go on to give some information about him, the kind of information which you have told us, and then I proceed that we must examine all this evidence, and I've said there that there is no cause to doubt the crucifixion of Jesus, or that he had assistance to aid him in his bid for survival. We may accept that one of them was a member of the Sanhedrin, and we may agree to speak of him as Joseph of Arimathea, even if we cannot be positive that this was his name. So there I am not making any kind of mistake, such as you have accused me of making, but the contrary, I have given certain qualifications in this matter. I have presented the evidence that there is from these documentary sources, such as Josephus, and then I have taken these and put them side by side, because this is fair to the reader, who must know what there is to be material, and I've said that there seems to be evidence from the result that there was a person concerned. His name may or may not have been Joseph of Arimathea, but that there was a member of the Sanhedrin who acted in this capacity, we have no reason to doubt.
Well, you say we have no reason to doubt. I think you have presented very good reason to doubt right in the passage that I read, and this is my point. Tonight over the air, you said this was the man who provided the drug. You have no evidence that a drug was present, but you say so. You say that this was the man. You now say, well, we don't know his name. He comes into the gospel once, and in earlier, because of something that I mentioned, you said it didn't seem to be too good because it was only mentioned once in the Bible. You remember when he said that, Waller? But now, on this case, he comes in once, but you very well want to believe in him and say there's no reason to doubt him. And you still want to sit there and say that you don't pick and choose. Of course you pick and choose,
sir. John. Chestnut, did you want to comment on that?
No, right, not fine. At all.
Walter, please get over a little bit so they're in the middle of that.
Dr. Schoenfield seems to keep saying that nobody is bringing out any evidence that the Passover plot is picking and choosing out of the gospel record. And I would, see as a copy of the Passover plot there, I would like to just take the references that from the book itself and show how this is done. Now, first of all, one of the clearest references that I can point to recap this is the fact of what you call the testimony document. This is found in page 229. We shall have more to say later about the lost teaching document or testimony document. Now, would you answer these questions for me? Then I'll know what you think about it. Have you ever seen any teaching or testimony document? Has any other scholar of the New Testament ever seen any testimony document? I can't. What do you want me to do, John? Sit on the thing?
No.
I'm practically climbing over it.
I wonder if I may suggest to you, Reverend Martin, if you realize, and I know that you are in the broadcasting business, you cannot talk like this. The microphone is there. Now, if you'll move a little bit over, you'll be able to talk with Dr. Schoenfield and stay on microphone.
I'm trying hard to keep the Passover plot in one hand and read the references to it in the other, and it's a hard job. But it's a lot of material here, and he put a lot of time in it, and I want to quote it accurately. You mentioned the testimony document, and this is very important, because from this point on, virtually, you keep referring to this testimony document, which is supposed to supply a great deal of information about Christianity. It was a short document that contained a great deal of material about Christ, or enough to carry the message along through the envoys, and you make mention of it. Now, this testimony document that you talk about, what evidence do you have? I'm not talking about theory, supposition, hypothesis, reconstruction, Formgeschichte, or anything else. I just want to know who has ever seen a testimony document.